for the week of November 27th, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 345, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Nashville, Tennessee, I'm Michael Giltz. Welcome back, Sperling.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
How was Brazil?
It was great. I mean, Expo Cine was bigger than I ever imagined it could be, given that I went last year and it was a growing show and it grew by leaps and bounds this year.
Was it well run?
It was well run. It had good programming. It you know, you learn stuff.
I mean, there were growing pains, I imagine, right?
Well, a little, but I mean, not nearly as much as at some shows where, you know, nothing runs on time and you don't really learn anything and the vendors aren't there. In this regard, there was a lot going on.
Terrific. What did you learn? What was the one unexpected thing you learned?
That all of Brazil's box office is really condensed into the north and northeast, and they are actively trying to spread out where box office comes from. So they're trying to build theaters in other parts of the country where their citizens can actually go and see movies.
So they're underscreened, and is the population less dense? Is that why it hasn't happened in the southern part of the country?
Yes, I believe that is really the case. And you know, what we also learned is, a couple things. One is that windows are a problem everywhere. That seems to be an issue. And the level of film rental, you know, at what rate film rental is charged, that's an issue. And apparently, everybody's a little scared at who was just elected president in the United States. Those are the things that I learned.
The business people?
The business people, yeah. I mean, everybody's a little kind of looking at the United States going, wow, okay, well, we'll see what happens there.
Were they literally wondering if it'll be bad for business for them in Brazil in the theatrical distribution market?
I think it's more a matter of what it means for the world in general and thus how it will trickle down to them.
Trickle down, there's a good word. Well, what else will we learn on the show? If they listen to your show, they met you in Brazil, and you said, listen to my Showbiz Sandbox podcast, what will they be hearing?
Well, on this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we offer up some delicious Thanksgiving leftovers. Michael, as you know, it was Thanksgiving here in the United States. We'll talk about the holiday box office and how Warner Brothers' Fantastic Beasts and Disney's Moana are doing. We'll also read some tea leaves, namely the nominations for the Indie Spirit Awards, and see if they predict the future for any Oscar hopefuls. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to tout new releases by Fanny Flagg, actress Lauren Graham, who is enjoying the buzz around the return of Gilmore Girls right now, and a memoir about a guy trying to write a memoir about director John Hughes. So it's like a circle within a snake eating its own tail there, it seems like. Mm-hmm. On Inside Baseball, we'll examine even more media fallout from the U.S. presidential election.
Our apologies.
Yes, we're going to try and make this as politics-free as possible. Now, here's the question. Is heightened sensitivity about which outlets do a puff piece on the Trumps and their potential cabinet just a momentary result of a tight election, or is it the new normal? And what are Facebook and Google doing about the proliferation of fake news? And is there a problem in the first place? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I think we were trying to say, is it their problem? Not, we know there's a problem with fake news, but the question is it Google and Facebook's problem to deal with? And the answer is, of course, yes. But yes, that's what we were trying to say there. But it is the box office. We're looking at box office around the world, not just North America. We pull information from ComScore. We have a link in our show notes. I'm starting to see ComScore in more news stories, not just in the trade papers. So they're getting their name out there. People starting to recognize it along with, you know, exhibitor relations in the past and Nielsen before that. So ComScore is starting to brand itself. That's working. And the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row, but it's our first time talking about it. It's Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. It's from the J.K. Rowling mind of J.K. Rowling and the universe of Harry Potter. It's a prequel in a way, set 100 years earlier, practically. It's set in 1920s New York. It had a great opening last weekend and another good weekend this time, $177 million worldwide. It's just under $500 million and counting.
I know where you can find all of the Fantastic Beasts.
Where?
At the movie theater, actually. There's a little movie going on.
That's true.
Yeah.
Did you see the movie?
I did, actually. And I have to say, I was never a big fan of the Harry Potter movies. The books were one thing. But the movies, there weren't too many of them that made me go, oh, that was a great movie, because they were so religiously, they just kind of stuck to the book so much that they just weren't good movies. In this mm-hmm. case, I thought, well, they didn't have a book to go on, and I thought it was a better movie.
I did too, actually. I thought it was better than most of the Harry Potter movies, and it was pretty good, a little more adult, just vaguely so. But Eddie Redmayne, who I'm not a big fan of, made a nice sort of autistic hero. You know, he barely made eye contact with anyone. He kept looking off in the corner. It was a little Dr. Doolittle when we met the Fantastic Beasts and he's sort of going to his petting zoo. But in general, it was actually not bad.
Yeah, it's funny that you should mention that he kind of came off as autistic, because I too was thinking as I'm watching this, he played that the character, the why his name is completely escaping me, the physicist.
Stephen Hawking.
Thank you. He played Stephen Hawking, and I thought, he does know that he doesn't have to always play that character in every movie from now on, right? I mean, because it's...
Well, Stephen Hawking's not autistic.
I know, but it seemed like he was kind of bringing some of his mannerisms from that role over to this role. It might just be his mannerisms.
Yeah, he's an odd duck. And an unusual hero for a franchise, but there it is, and it's off to a good start. Another franchise just launched is Moana. This is a Disney animated film, a classic Disney animated film with a princess of sorts, the daughter of a chief of a Polynesian island, trying to save the world alongside a demigod played by Dwayne Johnson. $71 million over the weekend, $97 million worldwide. So it's opened in a number of other territories. In North America, it opened up on Wednesday. And looking at the tracking over the weekend, it was the big winner for the Thanksgiving weekend. And it's a little bit behind Frozen at this stage, which also opened on Thanksgiving a few years ago. There's not a chance in hell Moana will make Frozen money, I don't think. But it was, you know, a successful beginning to this movie's path down to box office heaven.
You know what I would love to do with Moana versus Frozen? I would love to find out what the number of 3D shows versus 2D shows were, and then compare them to Moana, because I'm looking here just in, now this is totally anecdotal, but in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in some parts of Nevada, I'm looking and I'm seeing a lot of 2D shows, whereas the 3D shows, they are very specifically timed at, like, you know, 7:30 and 1:30 in the afternoon. That's it. There's two shows.
Yeah. But, well, I saw more than that, but I saw it today on a Sunday, and already you could see the 2D far outnumbering the 3D. It's a kids' movie. Kids in general don't want to see movies in 3D. It wasn't really designed to be seen in 3D in any way, shape, or form, so they offer it, but it's not really a big factor for the movie. So you're not surprised the families are staying away from that.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get over the fact that I couldn't remember Stephen Hawking's name.
At number three is Doctor Strange, another big franchise. This is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. $23 million over the weekend, $615 million worldwide, which makes it a hugely successful launch for this character in the Marvel world. It's only beaten so far by Guardians of the Galaxy, and if you want to count them, the Avengers. So that's a great launch, and it's certainly not done yet.
Think about it this way. Between Moana and Doctor Strange, Disney is just minting money.
Well, yeah, we've already spoken about how they've already set a record for the most money they've made in a year, and they're going to probably break the all-time record worldwide before December is done, thanks to upcoming Rogue One.
Yeah, I mean, Rogue One. Dude, yeah. By the way, you know, I found out their marketing budget for Rogue One. You know what it is?
A lot.
Guess how much it is. Just take a wild guess.
Well, I mean, it depends if you're counting in kind as a marketing budget, because I'm sure they have lots of deals where people associate them with the movie and that is valued at a certain amount. So, like, if I don't think McDonald's is a partner, but if a company franchise partners with you and they give you all this sort of exposure, you say, oh, that's worth $30 million. I don't know, but I'm sure they're spending $125 million, $150 million to market it.
You know, that is exactly what I said. That is, I thought the same exact thing. Of course, they have to spend a lot of money. It's a big, giant movie. You know what their marketing budget is? It's nothing. They literally have a minuscule marketing budget because they don't need to build awareness for this. Everybody knows.
Well, it's because everybody's part. I went to the movie theater. There were cups branded with Rogue One. That is marketing.
Yep, that's
so
right.
So if the Regal or Carmack Cinema chain wants to be in business with them and agrees to promote the movie, but that's worth a certain money. So they are marketing the movie. Absolutely, they're doing these deals and getting other people to associate with the movie. And I've seen TV ads, and I've seen there's got to be tie-ins and all that sort of stuff. So there's a ton of marketing. I've seen nothing but, you know, I don't, you know, you're just saying they're all in kind.
No, they're just not spending they're not doing the big ad spend with billboards and you know, standees and...
Well, there aren't ads in newspapers anymore, right?
And well, yeah, those went away. I mean,
but those will come in a week, those in the next 3 weeks,
that's
right?
That's what I would have thought. But, you know...
You're saying they're not going to spend money in mid-December on TV ads?
That's what I thought, that they would begin to spend money on TV ads, but they're hardly spending anything.
No, not now. A month from now.
Month from now, yes. Their ad buys have been curtailed. And not because, oh, well, we're you know...
Because everyone knows about it, and
exactly.
They don't want to get people sick of it.
Exactly.
Well, where's your source for the budget for Disney's budget for Rogue One?
Let's put it this way. It is a...
Were they boasting about how little they were spending?
No, they were shocked. It was an industry trade organization, which kind of narrows it down, and they were shocked, actually, that the budget was so low.
Huh. Now, does that work worldwide?
I'm only going with North America. Because okay.
Well, if you've got any information on Disney's budget, if you're doing an in-kind deal with them and you think that's worth 20 or 30 million and that should count towards their marketing, how can they let us know?
Well, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can search for us on Facebook and like our Facebook page. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and up our page should come.
All right. Well, going back to the box office, at number 4 is a film for adults. Not that all those earlier films weren't for adults, too. If it's good, it's a good movie. But here we have Allied, which is a World War II romantic drama starring Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard, directed by Robert Zemeckis. And over the Thanksgiving 5-day weekend, well, it's in 24 territories. So over the weekend, it made $22 million, and its total is $27 million worldwide. It's not a huge gangbuster opening, but, it's an adult film. If people like it, it could have legs. We'll have to see where it ends up. The reviews ranged from, oh, it's a nice old-fashioned drama, to it's boring.
Nice old-fashioned drama, meaning it's boring.
Yeah, depending on your taste. But I'm kind of vaguely intrigued, so maybe I'll check it out. And number 5, another film for adults, it's Arrival, starring Amy Adams. Another $18 million over the weekend, and that's just about to hit $100 million worldwide. So that's doing quite well, showing good legs for that movie. It had a nice hold over Thanksgiving, and it'll probably drop off a bit next weekend. But, you know, it's doing in good shape, I think.
You know, I've heard only good things about this movie, so I look forward to going to see it.
It was all right. A pretty good, better than average aliens coming to a Earth movie until they drop the ball on the finale. But I'm a big sci-fi geek, so I've seen it all before. And number 6 is Trolls, the animated film. $18 million over the weekend, and it's just about to hit $300 million. So they're in good shape.
You know what they're going to do with this movie, don't you?
No.
$300 million? Trolls 2.
Oh, make a sequel you make?
Trolls 2.
Oh, well, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We think the budget was about $125 million. They had a good soundtrack making money off of that, a big hit single that preceded it by 6 months. Merchandising, you know, this could be like Cars, whatever the movie makes at the box office. The goosing they've given the Trolls merchandise is probably off the charts, or that's certainly what you'll want to look at. That it's successful just as a film, but if they're making money there too, it's really going to happen. At number 7, you may see an uptick in Bible sales thanks to Hacksaw Ridge, the World War II drama directed by Mel Gibson and starring Andrew Garfield. $8 million over the weekend, $66 million worldwide. It's doing just fine. It cost $40 million to make. I don't think this is going to be an Oscar player, but it sets up Andrew Garfield nicely for his next movie, Silence, directed by Martin Scorsese.
Well, now speaking of Oscar players, Bad Santa 2 is number 8.
That's right. That's Billy Bob Thornton's long-awaited sequel. God knows why they waited so long, but they grossed $10 million over the weekend when all was said and done. Kind of a sad opening. They thought they would score in the mid-teens, and it was quite a bit lower than they expected. But they didn't spend a lot, so they'll probably be okay. At number 9, we're still waiting to see if this guy is going to be a winner or not. It's Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, the Tom Cruise flick. $6 million over the weekend. It's just at about $150 million worldwide. Finally, we get to go overseas to a new movie. It's from Korea. It's called My Annoying Brother. It's a South Korean comedy about two battling brothers. One is a judo competitor, and the other is just out of prison, and they're trying to get along with each other. It stars Jo Yoon-suk, who's made his name in the theater world of South Korea, starring in things like Spring Awakening, and Do Kyung-soo, who is a big K-pop star. So naturally, the movie ends with a big pop song that they duet on. But that opened up, and oh, his nickname is D.O., I think. I'm not sure if you call him Do or D.O. But anyway, it's a Korean comedy, $6 million on its opening weekend. We don't know the budget, but if you're in Korea and you do, let us know. I mean, this guy, by the way, these guys are big stars, especially D.O., the young guy from K-pop. In fact, like just a few weeks ago, he announced on Twitter he was going to stop accepting gifts from his fans. He's like, no more gifts. Please don't give me gifts. I can't take any more gifts. Young girls were just spending all their hard-earned money on giving him gifts. And he's like, it's too much. And that made news. Just the fact that he's stopping accepting gifts. And of course, most of them went to like charity anyway. But kind of interesting. It's a whole world of K-pop that we don't know much about. And number 11 is a Chinese film we talked about. It's called I Am Not Madame Bovary. Do you remember this movie, Sperling?
I do remember this movie.
That's right. There was a back and forth, fights between different groups. The exhibitors were downplaying the movie, and the director said it was politics. And the exhibitor said, we just don't think it's very commercial. Well, it was directed by Feng Xiaogang, and it's opened up. And this weekend, it made $6 million. But so far, it's made $46 million. And I don't know the budget. It's a period film. But that looks like a pretty good box office, right?
Yeah, $46 million. Absolutely. And it's actually doing quite well in China. I mean, I wish they'd release it here in the U.S. I'm sure they will.
It's here. It has. I think it's playing here.
Really? It doesn't have a domestic gross right now.
Oh, it doesn't? I thought it was in America. Maybe it opened and closed already. Or maybe it was another movie. There's so many films from overseas. In fact, if we jump down to number 17, there is an Indian film, a Bollywood film called Dear Zindagi, which I thought was African. In my mind, I was saying it like Isaac Dinesen, Dear Zindagi. But no, it's a Bollywood movie. And it's written, directed, and produced by Gauri Shinda, who's a female director and a rising talent. This is her second big movie after making a lot of commercial films. And because of the Thanksgiving weekend, this movie, which opened to about $2.5 million over the weekend worldwide, this movie opened up first in North America. It opened on Wednesday in the U.S. and Friday back in India. So that's the power of like a holiday weekend. And you know you've got Indian fans here in America, both people who are of that ethnic group and people who just love Bollywood films. And so they opened it up here early. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, and it did enough business on 153 screens to come in 15th in North America.
That's right. At number 12 is Almost Christmas, which is at about $35 million worldwide. At 13 is a Chinese film. This is directed by Ringo Lam, who's been a longtime player in the industry. It's called Sky on Fire. And it opened to $3.8 million total. Did not get good reviews. And I'm not sure about this movie, but it's Detective Conan, The Darkest Nightmare. We talked about it before. It's the 20th film in a franchise called the Case Closed franchise. It's a Japanese animated series. This one is the highest grossing yet, and it's opened up in some new territory and is making more money. So this weekend, it made $3 million. But worldwide, it's at $66 million. The Case Closed franchise chugs on from Japan. And at number 16, a movie that sort of got some good reviews in North America. It's a teen flick called The Edge of 17. It's made $3 million over the weekend and $10 million total. It was okay. I saw it, and it was all right. I was a little disappointed. I was hoping for a really good film. And the cast is appealing, but I didn't think it held up.
Well, I got to tell you, the trailer kills no matter where it plays.
Yes, no, it's a good trailer, and Woody Harrelson is funny. He's the best thing in the movie in a smaller role. And so, you know, it's certainly painless if you have an interest in seeing a teen flick, but I was hoping for more. And finally, here's a movie I love to talk about from Russia. It's called Panaflov's 28, and it's a Russian World War II movie about a famed group of 28 soldiers from Panflov. I hope I'm saying his name right, but some general or leader who had an infantry. And these soldiers had just rifles and weapons that didn't really work against tanks, but they had to hold off 54 German tanks for days. And they just did it with grit and determination, trying to protect Moscow and the motherland. What's funny about this movie, or interesting, is that one of the backers is a video game franchise, and the budget was crowdsourced. And just to make this movie about this fabled event that happened in World War II, sort of a Sparta type thing. And in fact, though, Soviet records say the tale is probably mostly false. But why let that stop you from having a good story? The budget's about $1.7 million, and it opened to $2.5 million. And for all I know, it's a great flick, you know? So interesting to see how that one plays out. But they got it out. They made their budget back on opening weekend. So more power to them.
Well, you know, if you ask the Oxford English Dictionary, the truth doesn't matter anymore. In fact, their word of the year is post-truth.
Well, that sounds like something you should have saved for Inside Baseball when we get to our political section.
Indeed.
But the truth is that a couple movies have just completely and utterly flopped, as always happens. One of the really notable ones is Inferno, the Ron Howard movie starring Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks had just had a good hit with Sully, and then now here he's got Inferno. In North America, this puppy has topped out at $35 million. That is a collapse. Boy, oh boy. But it almost doesn't even compare to Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. Ang Lee, a major director, a good property, a big best-selling book. Lots of talk about this film. Unfortunately, most of the talk was about the technology, which unfortunately most people couldn't see. There were only two theaters in America. Every review said, oh my God, this technology, I love it or I hate it. But if you want to see it, you have to go to New York or LA.
That
didn't work. And this movie is just absolutely dead in the water. It's topping out at $1.5 million. They're on 1,000 screens, and they're already down to just less than a couple $100,000. People are running in the opposite direction. I really don't quite know why, because Ang Lee has a great track record, and it's just a bizarre mess up in terms of technology and ability for people to see it and letting the technology be the story, which you didn't want. And that happened on The Hobbit, but those movies still made about $1 billion each. So something went badly wrong here, and it's too bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the second film and the third film, if you recall, Warner Brothers kind of put that high frame rate story to bed. They didn't want anybody talking about it.
Right, they tried all they could, right? They're like, don't talk about the high frame rate.
Right, exactly.
Well, everybody's talking, of course, about the Oscars, and they want to see every single event that comes out. Every group is a tea leaves that you can study to see what's going to happen. So we've got the Indie Spirit Awards, and it's just one of many that we're going to mention briefly, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. How do you want to tackle this?
Well, you know, they nominated a bunch of movies for a bunch of different categories. And like every awards group, some movies got nominations we didn't expect. And that's a surprise. Other movies were supposed to get a nomination and didn't. And that's another surprise. And we all try to read what that means. But certainly you look at their big five movies. One surprise that won't fall over to the Oscars is American Honey.
Yeah, there's no way I take that back. No, I don't foresee it. I don't foresee it. Have you seen this movie?
No, I haven't, but I will. But yeah, there's no chance in hell this is going to be an Oscar player. However, that's why the Indie Spirit Awards are announced. They're not there to promote the Oscars. They're there to shine a light on films that may or may not get Oscar attention. So hopefully they're doing their job and saying, you know what, we're not here to sort of be, be day players and sift through all the movies and do work for Oscar voters. We're here to pick the movies we love that may get ignored. And that certainly is one that American Honey counts as. Also nominated is Chronic, Jackie, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. And of course, three of those five are potential Oscar players. Jackie, of course, for the portrayal of Jackie Kennedy Onassis. Manchester by the Sea, which is now on, I think, about 64 screens and doing very well. It's almost in the top 10. And Moonlight, which has had a great run already. It's made like $8 million, which in my mind is an amazing amount of money for this art film. I mean, I'm thrilled for it. I'm very happy. But I saw Manchester by the Sea. I really liked it a lot. It's not as good as You Can Count on Me, but it's a very good Kenneth Lonergan film. Our friend Aaron Rich saw it. He hated it. But,
oh,
you know,
really?
Yeah. You know, he likes to be contrary.
I liked it. I have to say, Manchester by the Sea this year so far is one of the best films I've seen. I haven't seen Moonlight. I really have to get out and see that. This is a film about an inner city. It takes place in the inner city. Jack, you've already mentioned, is the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, kind of a biopic. American Honey is an independent film by Andrea Arnold, the British filmmaker who shoots everything in Academy ratio. So it looks like television, or I should say television from, 1950 to 1997 before.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and it's about, stars Shia LaBeouf and a young actress who's a newcomer as they kind of are on this magazine circuit. They go out and sell magazines in suburban neighborhoods, and it's all about their exploits.
It's a pure art house film.
Yes. Chronic.
It's 3 hours and nothing happens.
Chronic, have you seen Chronic?
Nope.
Do you know what it's about?
Nope.
Okay, well, that makes two of us.
I would have looked it up. I'm sorry. So those are five movies. Three of them are going to be Oscar players. I think Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight will both be on my best of the year list. I have to see the others. And one other film, I know I can hear Aaron yelling at me already saying the reason he said Manchester by the Sea is not good is not because he wants to be contrary, but because it's not good. And one movie he did think is very good is in their first feature list, and that is The Fitz, which I think was on Amazon or I think it's Amazon. And, you know, it's hard to keep what track on what. But it's a very good first feature about a young girl who gets caught up into boxing. But it's not a, you know, it's not a boxing movie, but it's a very well-made feature, terrific performances. I'm looking forward to check that out. And that's how I use these lists, you know? Are there movies I haven't seen yet that they say are among the best of the year? Then they're worth checking out.
Well, and, you know, Swiss Army Man, people are, you know, that's a Sundance film. The Witch, definitely worth seeing, first feature nominee. Are there any that where you really are kind of really, you've seen the film and you're really pulling for them?
For the Indie Spirit Awards?
Yes.
Well, no, because I haven't seen them all, so it's not fair to say I want Manchester by the Sea or Moonlight to win when I haven't seen American Honey, Chronic, or Jackie.
Okay.
That's what it made the nominations, and now you watch them all.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess we have some time to do that before the Independent Spirit Awards, which are held the day before the Academy Awards. So that will, I don't know, sometime in February 2017.
And that'll take place on February 25th, 2017.
Ah, thank you for the exact date there. Well, you couldn't give me any picks for the Independent Spirit Awards, but what about books? Do you have any books for me to read this week?
Of course I do.
That's right. It's time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And how's that for a plug there, Michael? The one book you're going to choose out of thousands which come out each week, what is the number one pick on bookfilter.com this week?
Well, the number one pick is by Fanny Flagg. It's called The Whole Town is Talking. She's the author of Fried Green Tomatoes, and this is a new novel that charts the life of a small town from when it was founded in the 1800s, year by year, right up to the present. So it's a clever book because you got people in the graveyard commenting on what's going on down in the town. It's a nice light book. Actress Lauren Graham has a memoir out, and you know she had a novel out last year or the year before, which was really quite good. I really enjoyed it. And there's also a really good book. There was a very good documentary film about AIDS called How to Survive a Plague, and that's been turned into a nonfiction book that's getting even better reviews if it's possible. So that one I have not read yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And there's Naming Thy Name, which is a work of literary scholarship about the bard and his famous series of sonnets to a young man. It turns out Shakespeare was in love, but not with Gwyneth Paltrow. Oh. However, if I was going to pick one book for the Showbiz Sandbox family, it would be Searching for John Hughes. This is a memoir by Jason Diamond. He's a kid who grew up in Chicago, and he was beaten by his dad, and his mother got custody, and then she abandoned him, and he's like sleeping on friends' couches while he's a teenager. He had a tough life growing up. And he found solace in the movies of John Hughes, who, of course, made his movies in and around Chicago. So he really identified with them. And he'd go around to the neighborhoods and look at the homes where they were shot, you know, for exteriors and stuff like that. And as an adult, he was a bartender, and he got the crazy idea he should write the biography of John Hughes. It hadn't been done yet. This is while John Hughes was still alive. And he tried to track him down. He tried to get an agent. And this book is about that story of his life and trying to track down John Hughes. And while he's doing all that, he starts writing for other people in magazines and websites. Turns out he's a pretty good writer, and now he's a very good writer. And he set up this whole collective in Brooklyn, and he has a career, and now it's led to this book about reaching out and trying to find John Hughes. So it's a cool story. It's one John Hughes would probably be producing if he was around today, and unfortunately he's gone, of course. But it's worth checking out, especially if you're a fan of his work or just the whole John Hughes milieu. So if you watch The Edge of 17, go home and buy the book, Searching for John Hughes by Jason Diamond.
Well, now, not to, you know, kind of go backwards in time, but I just had to go and see whether you picked Michael Chabon's Moonglow. He's a novelist, of course, as the number one pick last week, and you didn't. You actually, it was the number two pick. This is a book that has been kind of winning rave reviews. You picked something that I think our audience would appreciate, which is The Daily Show in Oral History.
That's right. It's, you know, every week, sometimes I go by, if there's a book that I absolutely am crazy about and think is the best book of the year, it's going to be number one, no matter what was happening the week before or after, what else is coming out. But sometimes I go, okay, I just had a mystery this week. I don't want to have a mystery 3 weeks in a row, or I had a fiction. Now I want a nonfiction. So that's sort of, you know, it's sort of a pile of books. I think of the front page of Book Filter as just a pile of books. You walk in the door and there's 10 or 12 or 15 books, and I'm saying, hey, check these out. So, you know, don't get too hung up on what's number one. Here's a pile of 10 or 15 books. You got The Daily Show biography. You got a fictional book by Michael Chabon, which I have read, and there's a review, and I think it's great. I think it's one of his best, right alongside Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and a couple others. I mean, it's a really good book, better than his last few. So I do recommend that book highly. And I think I even finished it after it came out. You know, I think I finished it during the week of the book. There's a lot of books that come out. It ain't easy. But certainly there it is right at the top. If you're wondering, you go to the front page. There it is. That's pretty good.
And Paulo Coelho has a new novel.
Yeah, about Mata Hari. Yeah, but people get hung up on the one, the two, the three. Oh, I'm it. I'm like, oh my God, it's just a, you know, there's 10 gazillion books. If it's one of the 10 I mentioned, that's pretty good. It's a big deal if I name that book one of the best of the week, even if it's not number one.
Oh, okay. I see what you're doing there. You're trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Westworld is a hit. That's what HBO is saying. They're renewing the sci-fi drama for a second season, along with the comedies Divorce and Insecure. They're also touting some audience numbers. Westworld is averaging 11.7 million viewers when you add up live viewing, reruns, VOD, and streaming. That might make it a top 20 show, though it's hard to say since the total viewers for most TV shows is a total mystery most of the time. Divorce is averaging 4.4 million viewers and Insecure 3.2 million, which HBO compares favorably to Veep and Girls. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because I'm a TV rating fanatic.
I know.
I'm also interested in Westworld, and you're telling me I have to wait 4 or 5 weeks or whatever into the run to find out that they're claiming it's a big fat hit. There's something very wrong with the industry when they cannot even let people know that there's big hit shows going on and they're not touting numbers and people can't find out how well the show is doing. That's HBO, of course, doesn't play the numbers game, but if they got a big hit, they love to talk about it. And what we don't know is, did it start averaging 20 million viewers and then 15 and then 12 and then 10, then 7, then 6, and now the average is 11 million, but it's been falling? Or is it steady or was it rising? I don't know.
Well, you know, there will be some listeners who will go back in time and say, well, geez, Michael, we just can't please you. You know, first you say don't give me the overnights because they mean nothing. And now
I want them when they're available. It's been 6 weeks. They have the full total
figures. You're saying, hey, look.
I'm saying 2-3 weeks into the run, we should have solid numbers for opening week and then the solid numbers for week two. And the entire industry has a problem of making consistent numbers available for all their TV shows on whatever platform. HBO is a slightly different story because they pretend not to play the numbers game. But everybody else, I don't know what shows are doing on ABC or TBS or, you know, it's a Netflix, of course. You don't know that either. Should I care? I think so. If you want to know if people are watching the show and if you've got a hit, you want to let that word get out. So they wait 6 weeks and bury it in a press release. That just doesn't make any sense to me because I was thinking the show was a flop and that's not good for Westworld.
Well, and you know, even if it was a flop, it probably wouldn't be canceled. In fact, ABC has seen its new drama Notorious do notoriously poorly in the ratings. So they cut back the first season episode from 13 to 9. Similarly, their show Conviction couldn't convince viewers to tune in, so they said they weren't ordering more episodes, but that the current batch would stay on the air for the moment. Fox's Making History also had its order trimmed. So two things are clear. None of these shows will make it to season two. Okay, so, you know, don't get too invested in these characters. And they're not the only thing to be canceled. Also canceled is telling audiences that a show has been canceled. Episodes may be trimmed. New scripts may not be ordered. Episodes already shot may be pulled from the schedule. But, hey, they could pop up on Hulu or online. You'll never see it again. Just don't call it canceled. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's a big whoop, right? This has been coming along for a long time. They, you know, if they want to show confidence, they order three more scripts, stuff like that. And they're afraid to say something's canceled. And you know what? It's not so crazy in a way because a show can find new life. It can end up on Hulu. It can get revived. It can get saved and shown on another platform and find enough juice to go for another season or two. Look at New Girl. So I can understand them not wanting to just sort of cut the axe and swing the axe and let people think, oh, well, that's over with. You know, but it gets a little silly sometimes when you're just ignoring reality. That doesn't help anybody.
Well, you know, certainly it's nice to see a show breathe and get, you know, have a chance to find its audience or vice versa, an audience a chance to find the show. What is an issue, at least within the industry, is that some of these shows remaining on the air are preventing other shows that are shot, okay, shows that will probably hit the air, you know, come, you know, January, February time. The people who are in those shows and the people that are in the shows that are kind of trickling away, they're not canceled.
They're locked in place by their contracts and they can't move on to something else.
That's where I was headed. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah,
that's
it's
a bit of an issue.
If they're just not bothering to release people. But they can do that without officially canceling the show for the world to know. You know, they can just release them quietly.
So well, but the times that they've done that, and they have done that in the past, the times they have, you know, it kind of spreads out. Oh, well, you're looking for a job. I guess that show is canceled.
Well, duh, it is canceled. If they cut back the order from 13 to 9, we all know it's canceled. There's no doubt if you can't, that the show's dead in the water. There's no doubt. So they're not kidding anybody.
Yeah, I guess I don't know why they. You know what? We'll have to get some TV exec on to ask, why don't you use the word canceled anymore? We're still waiting for details, but actors and stage managers working off-Broadway won a major victory with significant pay increases so they can get closer to what is known as an actual living wage in an industry where most actors are unemployed most of the time. But guess what? This isn't a loss for off-Broadway theaters and producers. It's a victory for them as well. They avoided a strike, they avoided ill will from the people who create their shows and the media that loves them, and they began to share more of the profits that off-Broadway is producing. After all, off-Broadway shows regularly charge $80 to $125 and more for full-price tickets. The cast and crew should share in that. It's hard to make shows that work without going to Broadway, but it's even harder when your cast and crew can't pay their rent. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, and I'm glad we emphasize this, because you don't have a healthy industry if your crew and your actors and the people working on your shows can't make a living wage. So don't think you're successful if you're raking in bucks and they're on unemployment lines, or they're scraping together noodles, ramen noodles for their dinner 3 nights a week. You know, so this is not a sign of like winners and losers. You should want to share it. And I think it's a sign that they did and they recognized, look, off-Broadway is a lot more vibrant than it's been in years. We're charging more money. We have to share this if we want a healthy industry. We want everybody to win when we're winning. And I think that's what they did.
Dave Chappelle is following up his highly rated post-election appearance on Saturday Night Live with plans to film his stand-up shows for Netflix. The three-show deal includes a new comedy special and two previously unreleased performances Chappelle has had in the vault. All three will be released simultaneously on Netflix in 2017. Chris Rock previously made headlines by agreeing to film two new specials for Netflix for a cool $40 million. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. Man gets job, and he could have had the job anytime he wanted with any network he wanted. The only thing I question is, I know Netflix drops seasons all at once, but why the hell would you do it with three comedy specials?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. I would definitely
at least 1 week apart, if not a month, especially the two older ones, lead up to the big one,
yeah,
to the new one. You know, that's just stupid. It's not fun to watch three comedy specials in a row. they got to rethink that.
You know, speaking of rethinking, the great Japanese director Hayao Miyazaki is coming out of retirement.
Nice segue.
Yeah, finally.
Well done, Sperling. Well done.
He was
on the fly.
Exactly. Miyazaki was overseeing a short called Boro, the Caterpillar, and said, you know what? This should be a feature-length film. He realized even if it takes 5 years to create, he'll still only be 80. And hey, 80 is the new 65 and isn't 81. Just about the perfect age to win an Oscar. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I'm very excited. He's one of the greats. I'm glad he's got one more movie in him. I hope it's up to his standards. And I'm sure it will be.
You know, I'm actually tempted to make a joke here about having some inside industry knowledge about why Miyazaki did this. And it all has to do with his staying a part of the Academy that he needed, you know, to keep his credits up. But, you know, let's face it, that's not true.
There you go.
Bob Dylan sent a personal letter to the Nobel Committee, emphasizing he was honored, but saying prior commitments make it impossible for him to attend. One might assume the always touring Dylan had some concerts, but none for December are listed on his website as of yet. However, as part of receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature, Dylan is committing to presenting a Nobel lecture within 6 months of the December 10th ceremony. Big deal, big whoop.
Ah, it's a big whoop whether he attends or not. He's gotten Presidential Medal of Freedom and lots of other stuff. I don't know why he wouldn't go for this in particular, but he was polite, he's respectful, and he's going to do that talk, and that's something I'm really going to look forward to.
You know, speaking of literature, Michael, and of course that's the the prize that Dylan won, the Nobel Prize for Literature, and I don't know why we didn't cover this in our book filter segment, but Colson Whitehead won the National Book Award here in the United States for The Underground Railroad, which is a book that you had mentioned previously.
Oh, yeah, it's a terrific book. He's a great writer. I'm very excited to see that win. Between that and The Sellout by Paul Beatty winning the Booker, it's just been a great year.
So the Marvel comic book superheroes are coming to ABC in a new series. But first, they're coming to IMAX. The plan is to start filming episodes. Some version of the first two will debut on IMAX screens in the late summer of 2017. It's the most elaborate teaser ever for a TV series that will then launch in the fall. If it worked for Game of Thrones, why not Black Bolt and his family? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? It's just a stunt. It's a way of bringing attention to a new TV show, but, you know, good for them. The problem I see is that if they spend too much money on the special effects in the pilot, like Battlestar Galactica did, the one in the 70s, they blow the budget on the pilot, and then every episode after that looks tame. You know, you got to maintain certain standards, but I think TV special effects now are good enough that they can handle being blown up on IMAX, and, you know, I think it's just a smart way to bring attention to a new show.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how exhibitors and movie theater owners play this out. I mean, certainly...
Well, why not, right? If they can make money off of opera in the theater, they're happy to have you come in and watch the season premiere of Game of Thrones or the season finale, whatever
absolutely.
They did. Yeah, why not? Popcorn sales and the ticket sales.
Broadway's Shuffle Along is one of the best shows of the year, but it closed abruptly and now lawsuits are headed to court. The producers of the show say they bought $14 million worth of insurance policies in case star Audra McDonald was injured or ill or died, preventing her from performing or shutting the show down entirely. Well, McDonald got pregnant and the show closed, citing her pregnancy in particular. The insurers say getting pregnant is not an illness. Thank you very much. And we'll be keeping our $14 million if you don't mind. Great show, though. The producers are saying it's not an illness, which courts have ruled is a normal biological function and doesn't qualify as such, but in fact, an accident. I don't know. I guess you could say that, you know, sometimes getting pregnant is an accident. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, yeah, she's 45 when she got pregnant, and so she wasn't expecting to get pregnant. She tried for years. She committed to a year in the show, or 52 weeks, I should say, because she was going to be interrupting it already right after it opened. But it's kind of amazing if you think about it. The insurers are saying, hey, this is not an illness. You know, this is not an accident. Sorry about that. And they're saying, well, okay, what do you want? You wanted to get an abortion? You know, it's like, what exactly are you saying? You know, what should she have done? Not have sex? If she gets pregnant, not get an abortion? Is that what you're saying would be reasonable for the insurer to expect? So it's going to be an interesting case, to say the least. I'm really looking forward to seeing how it turns out. I just wish I could go see the show again because it was great.
He who controls the spice controls the universe. And in Hollywood, he who controls major franchises controls the box office, as we've seen over the past couple of years. That surely is why Legendary has acquired the rights to the classic sci-fi novel Dune by Frank Herbert. They've snared film and TV rights worldwide to the novel, which is set on the desert planet Arrakis, the only known source in the universe for quote-unquote spice, the drug necessary for interstellar travel. The book became a famous flop by director David Lynch, which people insist against all evidence has since become a cult favorite. I don't see that.
It's not.
Yeah, it's not a cult favorite.
They just say it because it was a flop. You know, every flop is assumed to be a cult favorite by somebody.
Yeah, you know, I actually saw that movie twice in movie theaters. That in turn was expanded into a TV version and then followed by two entirely new miniseries made for the Sci-Fi Channel that remain among its highest rated shows ever. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? They acquired books. Let's see what they do with it. But why just Dune? I can't understand this. They acquired the rights to the one book. I mean, there are six books written by Frank Herbert, and his son Brian, along with Kevin J. Anderson, have done like a dozen more. Why wouldn't you have the rights to all of them, or at least the six that Frank Herbert did? I'm just a little bemused by that. Not that you really want rights for the other books that Frank Herbert wrote, because they're pretty awful.
Oh, really?
They go way off into philosophy and La La Land. They're completely almost plotless. They're really, it's kind of like, yeah, they're just not, they're not very filmic. Let's just put it that way. And you can play in that world, I guess, but it seems to me you'd still want the rights to all of them anyway.
You know, I read Dune and I remember thinking that was hard enough to get through.
Don't read the rest.
Yeah. Now that you're telling me how bad
like
the rest of them were.
Like the Ender's Game, like the books after the first one get pretty bad, pretty quick.
The International Emmys were handed out recently, a great primer for anyone in any country looking for good TV that's probably streaming online somewhere, somewhere that they're already paying for, in fact. So write these down if you're not watching them already. The very well-reviewed German drama Deutschland 83 has been renewed for a second season and took the prize for top drama. The UK's Hoff the Record won Best Comedy. That's a mockumentary starring David Hasselhoff as, guess what, David Hasselhoff moving to the UK and looking to jumpstart his career. If you're not confused yet, it's playing on the TV channel called Dave, which you might think shows only David Hasselhoff projects, but you'd be wrong. The best reality show is All for Sweden, based on the Norwegian show called, you guessed it, All for Norway. They combine a competition with genealogy as Swedish Americans go to the homeland to learn more about their roots and must survive each week to unearth more about their families. And the top telenovela is Brazil's Hidden Secrets, a.k.a. Verdades Secretas. What?
There he goes. True Secrets.
Oh,
yes.
you were going to try and jump in there and save me from
that. Yeah,
Secretas. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a top prize. I think they've really branded themselves well. These are some really good shows. Deutschland 83, by the way, it's kind of like The Americans. It's about an East German spy sent to West Germany undercover. It aired on Sundance in 2015. It was the first German language series to air in the U.S. I think we even talked about it. I have no idea what took them so long to get a sequel. It did great. It was popular all over the world. Now it's won this. I don't know what they were waiting for, but thank God.
Well, before we get a whole bunch of emails to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, I know that it's Secretas, not Secretas. So, okay, Kanye West began a few shows after the election with long, rambling, confused political statements. Kind of like, you know, all of our conversations after the election. Among other things, he said he didn't bother to vote, but if he did, he would have voted for Trump, prompting boos from audience members. A few nights later, West talked on and on for 40 minutes or more, stopping the show while he rambled on to this topic and that topic. He played only three songs. Just when you thought it couldn't get any crazier, his sold-out tour was put on hold while West returned home and was hospitalized, reportedly for exhaustion. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for him and his family. You know, I mean, the guy needs help, whether it's a physical or mental or whatever's going on. He's just a troubled person, and I hope there's some people around him who will help him get the help he needs. I mean, you can't, you know, he's got a sold out tour. You got to prepare for it. It's a lot of big money. It's what you do. He puts on great live shows. And this is just a travesty, whatever's going on. We saw this. I'm not comparing him to the suicide of Amy Winehouse, but I'm just saying you're watching him sort of implode career wise in a way with what's going on here. It's just something's not healthy here.
Amazon has been battling paid reviewers on its website for a while now. But it's also been battling trolls, people who say malicious hate speech or simply love to stir things up. And we're not talking about the movie trolls, we're talking about internet trolls. Case in point, the new memoir by Fox anchor Megyn Kelly. She's seen her book pilloried by a string of one-star reviews making nasty pointed comments about Kelly, while clearly written by people who haven't even read the book, and often people who boast about not having read her book. So obviously, they haven't read the book. For days, the battle went back and forth with trolls posting one-star reviews and other people voting them up so they'd be the first to appear. And it continues on and on. For a while, the book had a dreadful total review average. Now, she has more than 300 reviews on Amazon and a four-star average. But go to the actual page for the book and you'll see, you know, there are tons of one-star reviews, a few two-star reviews, and one three-star review. Very strange for a book with a four-star average. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for Amazon. It's part of, you know, they've been cleaning up their website, trying to clamp down on fake reviews and bad reviews and paid reviews. And this is something they've always had to deal with. And this is just another highlight. It's just like Facebook and Google that we'll be talking about soon. You've got a universe of customers and they depend on you for a trusted environment. And you're like, is it my problem that these people are posting these fake reviews about this one book? And the answer is yes.
Yes, it is. The Metropolitan Opera faces an almost existential crisis. Tickets to the opera can be afforded by only the wealthy. Despite constant outreach, projects like live streaming the Met in movie theaters around the world, opera on the radio, and so on, it's still a rarefied art form with a tiny, seemingly dwindling base.
Namely me.
Yeah, and me.
I love it.
And they're running out of money, by the way, the Met. Stepping into the breach is the Metropolitan Opera Guild, an independent body which exists to support the Met. They have a memorabilia collection that is in storage and rarely seen. Now they want permission in court to sell it off and split the proceeds, perhaps $1 million or more, with the Met. Items that might come under the gavel include a gold cigarette holder that belonged to singer Ezio Pinza and a jeweled baton owned by composer Richard Wagner. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's the numbers. It seems like a big whoop.
I agree.
You know, this stuff should be sold to a museum or somebody, cultural museum, so they can be displayed so everyone can see it and the money can go to the Met. Why are you going to auction it off to private collections just for a couple hundred thousand dollars? That's not going to do any good for the Met. So it just seems bad to have it under lock and key. Great to raise money for the Met, but a shame if they can't make it available somehow with a preemptive bid to allow it to be on display at the Met.
For that God would be sake. Nice.
You know, tours of the Met, you know, be nice to have the stuff there and seen by people. It's a very tiny lobby, I must say. There's not a lot of space to show stuff off. So I'm not quite sure where they would do it, but something should be done.
Maybe they could do it at the Met across the park there at Central Park in New York and have a special, you know.
Met at the Met.
Yeah, exactly. Now, here's a question, Michael. How do you say step up in Mandarin?
Oh, should I look it up? I didn't even think of that.
I don't know. I don't know how you say it, but we're soon going to find out because the dance movie franchise is getting a Step Up 6 geared towards a Chinese audience. Lionsgate and new partners have combined for a new edition to be directed by Ron Yuan with an all Chinese cast and filming to take place in Beijing and Los Angeles starting in December. The first five films grossed more than $660 million worldwide on a total budget of about $92 million, launching the career of Channing Tatum in the process. There's also a web series being created for YouTube Red that Tatum is one of the producers of. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal for Jazzin, which I think is how you say step up in Mandarin. At least that's what I looked up online just now. It's an extension of a franchise. I mean, we've seen this with TV shows and movies all throughout history, so it just makes perfect sense. Awfully profitable one, my God. Six movies, now another one, and TV show that just keeps going. People love dance.
That's how you say it.
I couldn't hear it. I looked it up.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, I believe, and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're going to have to get a little political, but really, we're talking about the media more than the election. It's how the media covered the election and what the fallout is, effectively, and specifically, what's going on at Facebook and Google and why all these fake news stories are around and what Facebook and Google are doing about it.
Well, let me ask you a question first. You just referred to the media.
Right.
And in fact, a German minister says Facebook should be treated as a media company, not a tech company, in terms of how they are regulated. And that's, of course, in the context of the European Union. Do you agree with him? You just said that. Or are they like a phone company? Are they like, hey, we're not responsible for the phone conversations you have on your phone, and we're not responsible for what you post on your Facebook page. We're just a platform that people can use.
This is the sticky wicket, isn't it? I mean, this is what
$64 question.
Yeah, this is what everybody has been discussing, because the reality is they don't necessarily tell you to go and post fake news on their website, but that's what people are doing. And more, they are a technology company that is working on technology, but one that more and more is focused on media.
Well, that's right. And they keep reaching out and doing deals. And so media is streaming through Facebook. And so it's just inevitable that there's going to be pushback or new ways of having to see yourself and how new ways you're going to be regulated. The fact is, when you talk about people posting fake news stories, it's a business. People in parts of the world were making money by creating websites with clickable stuff. Sometimes it was dog with three heads, you know, that's the National Enquirer or Star Magazine, aliens are taking over Elvis. Nowadays, or during the election, it was stuff about the election, fake news stories about Clinton and Trump and all that. And Facebook and Google had a big problem. Even 2 days after the election, I think I mentioned before, I went to Google what the popular vote tally was, and I got a fake website with the wrong results. But they made money because I clicked on the link and I went to their website, and the ads they have posted sent them a couple pennies. And so people who could make money off that for a few months or a few years did it. And now Facebook and Google have taken what I think is a very reasonable first step. They said, all right, if we identify a website as being a fake website, it's not a website that's generating news stories. It's just clearly a fake, we are not going to allow them to be part of our ad system. They can be posted, people can link to them, but they're not going to make any money. So for the people who are doing this just to make money, they're not motivated by ideology or anything else. They're just trying to make a quick $30,000 during the 6 months of the election. That's choked off, and that isn't going to work. When they identify you, they say no ads for you, you're cut off, and then you're not going to have any incentive to create your websites. So I thought that was a good first step.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's one of the things that Google has done for years with websites that, you know, whether they, you know, have child pornography or pornography in general.
Or try to hit you with bad pop-ups or downloads and crap like that, you know? You go to a website and suddenly you're trapped in a circle of unending hell because you can't get away from it.
They say, we'll definitely index your site, but you can't place our ads there. You can't make money off of us in that way.
And they push you way down on the ranking.
Correct, yes.
So that's a good first step. And there are a lot of other steps. We've got a link to a story by a professor a CUNY professor, with a lot of solid suggestions of how they could help. I mean, Twitter took years to do a good job in letting people say, I'm getting this person send me nasty personal messages. Like, I'd really like not to have them do that, or racist messages, or, you know, they'd at least like the chance to flag it. And it very simple stuff that you think they would have done years ago. And it took them a while to catch up with what their responsibility was, or what would make a good environment so they could keep making money.
Right. Well, the big problem is, of course, the First Amendment issues that they're trying not to get involved in.
There are none. There's no legal obligation for Facebook to carry any website. There's no legal obligation for Google to index it. You're free to post your website. They don't have to link to you. That's not a First Amendment issue. If the government shut your website down, then it's a First Amendment issue. It's not a First Amendment issue if I choose not to link to your website. That isn't a First Amendment. People get confused by that all the time.
Well, apparently you can't say anything bad to or about the new presidential administration here in the U.S., because if you do, and you do it in a public way, you will get a tweet aimed at you. And by that, I mean Donald Trump will take to Twitter and ask you to apologize in front of the entire world. And that's what happened to the cast of Hamilton, which went out and on a Friday evening after the show, they, you know, took their bows.
This has been covered to death.
It's been covered to death. But I think this is what people are kind of worried about. Let me ask you this, Michael. As somebody who goes to the theater, do you find it breaking that fourth wall to be totally abnormal and totally wrong?
Well, they didn't break the fourth wall. It was after the show. It was during the bows that they made a brief public statement that was very respectful. It acknowledged the vice president-elect. It's made a heartfelt plea that I don't think anyone should or could have taken issue with. They do post-bow speeches all the time, raising money for charities and other things, or thanking them, or for saying it's the last night for this cast member. So it's not only not unusual or strange, it happens all the time. And if you go to the theater, you know that. It's perfectly normal.
I was there for the last performance that Tom Hulce did of A Few Good Men.
Very cool.
So that was kind of interesting. It was kind of fun to see that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they kind of did a little thing afterwards. My big issue with the media these days is watching the media kind of run off to Trump Tower to have an off-the-record conversation with the president-elect. I just think there's no reason to be holding off-the-record conversations with the media.
I agree with that. Trump had a get-together with all the executives. Well, it wasn't like reporters. It was like top executives at all the major media companies. And he kind of told them to knuckle under. Said, hey, you guys messed around with me and, you know, you gave me a lot of bad press and enough of that. It was frightening in a way. But the New York Times, and they had back and forth, they refused to do it. They insisted he come to them. They insisted that there be an on-the-record component so he could talk to the editorial team and the executives. But then they also wanted an on-the-record meeting with journalists who would talk about it and report on it. He agreed to do that. And then that went forward. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of attention paid. Michael Wolff at The Hollywood Reporter kind of shocked me right after the election. He wrote a story saying, hey, you know, suck it up. He won the election. You're in the media going to want him to do stuff for you. He's going to want you to do stuff for him. So, you know, work together and get over it. And then he followed his own advice by immediately writing a fawning profile of the racist Steve Bannon and acting like he was a political genius rather than a leader of a racist far right movement. And he's now, of course, Trump's chief advisor. And, other people started calling him out on that. So you're getting a lot of back and forth, a lot of you know, touchy feelings, a lot of anger and focus and political activism that's going to be going on for a long, long time. You know, Today's Show does a story on Thanksgiving and what Trump will do. They quote his former butler, who was worked for him for 20 years. They fail to mention his butler was so violently racist and threatening to kill President Obama that he had to be investigated by the Secret Service. I mean, is that really a guy you do and call up to have a nice puff profile about Thanksgiving on? You know, it's just like that guy threatened the current president of the United States. I don't think you should be having him on your show as a little talking head.
Well,
talking
did they
about
know that? Was that commonly known before they did? They did the piece?
Absolutely. It was national news when absolutely. And it's their job to know. Even if they did know, you don't have someone on, you know. But no, it was widely known. Absolutely. You Google them and you would have known that. So, yeah, it wasn't a secret. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. We'll have to see where it ends up. But I think the biggest problem is for Facebook and Google trying to figure out what can we do. And I see other people saying, hey, look, you know, you got an algorithm, you follow it to a website, you can see a news story. Does it have links? Does it link back to another source? Is that source trusted? If it doesn't link back to a source, you're less likely to trust it. I mean, there's lots of things they do to rank stories that should apply to fake news that should be pretty easy for them to say, yeah, this is not a trusted source. We're going to shove this way down on our ranking list. But right now, or at least for a while, you were seeing them right at the top. So they got a big problem. It really threatens them as a safe space or a neutral space, which is what they want to be seen as. And that's not what it's seen as right now when you go on there and you find fake stuff that's not true.
Well, and I think a part of the issue came with Zuckerberg saying, we totally, you know, fake news. There's like 1% fake news on our website. And, you know, Facebook isn't filled with fake news. And it had nothing. We didn't sway the election in any way, shape, or form. And he kind of reiterated that about three times during the week after the election. And then finally, on November, I think it was 18th, a Friday, he kind of went, yeah, okay, fine. Well, we'll have to address this in some way, shape, or form. And everybody went, yeah, but that's kind of like closing the door to the barn after the horses have left. So,
well, the funny thing was he did, I think, a live something or other and online. And when he did that, talking about there wasn't fake news, there was a fake news story up in the upper right and an ad or something. Some people pointed out, by the way, that thing behind you is a fake news story. So, yeah. So we'll be moving back on into our, we'll pretend none of this happened and go right back to our regular entertainment coverage. But there is still fallout from the election.
Yes.
And there's also people who died, right?
Yeah, well, I've never seen people talk this much about politics. Even in 2000, when there was the whole Al Gore, George W. Bush election, people talked about it for a while, but never like this. This, I think, is kind of a new level. And the media really is, there's kind of an edginess now the media has about what they're going to face with a President Trump. One person will not be facing it. As you mentioned, Michael, some people did pass away over the past 2 weeks, including PBS journalist Gwen Ifill, who used to actually moderate presidential debates.
That's right. She died of uterine cancer at 61, a real loss to journalism. Also dying over the past 2 weeks is soul singer Sharon Jones, who I interviewed with. She's a great, like a James Brown. She was that much of a great all-around entertainer. She just had a film about herself in movie theaters, but she's a great performer. She has a couple of great, great albums, so you can always check her out. An Oscar-winning production designer died. Paul Silbert, the brother of Richard Silbert, also a great Oscar-winning production designer. Paul won for Heaven Can Wait. He also worked on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Prince of Tides, and lots of other movies.
And of course, finally, we have to mention Florence Henderson, who was the mother on The Brady Bunch.
That's right. She died at 82. And that's the power of TV back in the day when everybody watched the same shows and they made such a big impression because you'd have 30, 40 million people watching them and then endless reruns. You know, she was a mom and she just sort of is the image of mom in suburban America for many, many years, especially during an era when there's so much turmoil like Vietnam. Which makes today still seem like patty cake, I think, in comparison so far. You know, she had a long career. She was on The Tonight Show a lot with Jack Parr and Johnny Carson.
In fact, she was the first female guest host of The Tonight Show.
Oh, my God, that's right, even before Joan Rivers.
Yes, which I did not know until she passed away.
Well, there you go. That's why you read great obits, especially like those in the New York Times. And there's a new movie coming out in February or March about the New York Times obituary section and the people who write them. And that comes out in at film form, at least in New York City, I think mid-February or early March.
And do you know the name of this film?
And the name of the movie is called Obit. It played, I think, at the Tribeca Film Festival and is now getting a commercial release.
Well, our podcast isn't commercially released. It's free to you, and you can listen to it every single week. In fact, if you subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, any podcast aggregator, that's usually where you can find our podcast. If you can't find it there, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Please rate and review the show in those aggregators. Call us, email us. Let us know what you think of the show, or if you have comments on any of the stories we talked about, please let us know, and we can kind of pass those along to our listeners. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us. We're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can follow us on or like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's ivotedsoigettobitch.com.
Oh, okay. Well, if that is a place where you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, why not head on over to, the Huffington Post, or you can head over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his coverage is aggregated. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.